Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, while the state moves to reopen more of the economy, there are warning signs. We'll discuss the possibility of a rise in coronavirus cases right here in Illinois. We'll hear how the pandemic has played out in a central Illinois nursing home through emergency calls.
We have a resident, we just got the results back. She tested positive for COVID.
I can't breathe. I can't catch my breath.
We'll also learn about the history of slavery right here in Illinois and a somewhat rare occurrence, a bear makes its way into the state. That and more this hour on Statewide. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family as the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, it's been a difficult spring as the pandemic has kept people apart and limited what activities can take place. This weekend, the state of Illinois lifted some of those restrictions, but will things continue to improve when it comes to the spread of COVID-19 or get worse? We'll discuss that. Also, we listened to emergency calls made during a coronavirus outbreak at a Bloomington nursing home. And later, you might think of slavery as only happening in the South, but there were slaves right here in Illinois. We'll learn why and how long slavery was allowed in the state. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. Well, this is the first weekend restaurants in Illinois can open for indoor service under the governor's reopening plan. Bill Wheelhouse spoke with Sam Toya. He's the president of the Illinois Restaurant Association about his expectations as the state enters what's being called Phase 4.
It has been devastating for the restaurants here in the state of Illinois over the last 12 weeks. We started with 594,000 people working in the industry at the beginning of the year, and 321,000 of them are now either on unemployment or furloughed. At the beginning of the year, there was over 25,000 restaurants here in the state of Illinois, and the National Restaurant Association is predicting that 20 to 25% of the restaurants will not reopen. So the restaurant industry has been hemorrhaging out here, but we're seeing some light at the end of the tunnel here as we move into Phase 4. So in Phase 4, what we see as the governor confirms that the state is ready to safely reopen, that you have to have your tables 6 feet apart. Social distancing is very, very important. And then also, you got to make sure all your staff is using PPE, which obviously is very important. That's obviously face covering, hand sanitizers, gloves. We in the restaurant industry have some great safety protocols in place. We know how to do this. You know, we are an industry that is regulated, frequently inspected by public health officials on a regular basis. So we're ready to move into America 2.0.
Do you still see restaurants offering curbside service like they have been?
I do think they will. I think what restaurant owners, operators have found out here over the last 12 weeks is that they definitely, are going to keep curbside pickup and also delivery. Delivery, probably when the pandemic started, probably counted maybe for 8 to 10% of their business model. I think going forward, you're going to see carry out, curbside pickup, and delivery count for maybe upwards to 20% of restaurant business.
What do you think will be the hardest part about reopening?
You know, it's kind of like reopening a restaurant. You got to bring your team members back. You got to make sure your restaurant is ready to up and run and serve its customers. But bringing the team members back, because you got to make sure that your team members are ready to go back to work, because people go into restaurants for the food, but they come back for the service. So you want to try to bring back your veteran team members, but you're also going to bring in some new team members as well. So you got to make sure they get trained.
What are the indicators you'll be watching to keep a tab on statewide recovery in terms of restaurants?
Well, obviously, we'll be communicating with our members to see how sales are they ticking up. I would imagine they will. Obviously, the state will also be noticing sales taxes, too. We'll see if the sales tax start coming in. Because you got to remember, we were predicted to do north of $30 billion in sales. The restaurant industry was predicted to do $30 billion in sales here in the state of Illinois. for 2020. Obviously, that's not going to happen. We lost over $600 million in sales alone in in April. So we're probably not going to hit our $30 billion, but that produced over 10% in taxes, sales taxes to local municipality in the state. That was over $3 billion in sales tax.
Is there any kind of advice you're extending to your member restaurants as we head into this phase?
Yes. You know, we want to make sure we have a pledge there, Illinois Restaurant Association pledge, that we as restaurant owners, operators, pledge to our customers and our customers pledge to the restaurant. So if we are ready for America 2.0. We're a highly regulated industry. We know how to do this. It's all about the public safety and health of our team members and guests. And what's very important is the social distancing. We all know that face covering gloves. So it's very important when you go into a restaurant, you have your face cover on. And then when you sit down, you can take it off while you're eating. But if you have to get up to go to the restroom, you put your face covering back on. You know that team members are washing their hands every 30 minutes, which we always, again, like I said, we are a highly regulated industry. We know how to do this, but we'll even do it extra cautious. So when customers, your listeners, walk into restaurants, they can see that team members have face coverings on. They can see that there's social distancing going on. So again, what my recommendation is that we follow the rules that the governor and his team have put out there in phase four, social distancing, PPE in place.
Toya, like the head of many industry groups, remains publicly optimistic. He says restaurants will bounce back and the state will remain a culinary hub in the nation. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
Movie theaters say the governor's reopening plan could make it hard for them to turn a profit. Theaters are among the entertainment venues which can open this weekend, but Chris Johnson, president of the National Association of Theater Owners in Illinois, says they were led to believe they'd be able to allow more people than the new rules say. The governor is limiting attendance to 50 people per screen. Johnson says there are larger venues which could accommodate more. And while they could start showing films Friday, Johnson says most will be waiting until July to reopen.
Because there aren't any new movies until July. We're, you know, first and foremost, we're in the new movie business. So in order to, you know, give the product that our guests want, they want new movies.
The theaters want the state to allow 50% occupancy in each screening room. With more restrictions being lifted now, does it mean the worst of the pandemic is behind us? Experts who deal with public health, vulnerable populations, and the economy have been surveyed by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. The findings are put together in what's called a pandemic stress indicator. The most recent survey found nearly half saying that a move back, possibly all the way to a stay-at-home order, could occur again this year. To talk more about it, I visited with the IGPA's director, Robin Fretwell-Wilson, and U of I professor, Brian Gaines, who tells us why some dark clouds could be on the horizon.
I'm also thinking maybe a little bit like Eeyore here, that moving to phase four doesn't mean we can't slide back, that there's some chance we could, with enough outbreaks, with the decline in hospital capacity, shift back to phase three. And in fact, I've been conducting a survey of experts and asked them recently if they think there's a chance that Illinois will fall back all the way back to phase two. And 43% of them thought that could happen between August and December. So I'd caution anyone who thinks we got quickly from 2 to 3 to 4, it's all sunshine ahead, that in fact, there's not a ratchet here. We could end up with back in the more restrictive regime with worse conditions.
Robin, I talked to you just recently. We discussed sort of the political angles and, of course, how local officials are facing a lot of pressure to open things up. It seems as though going backward would really be a problem for them. And certainly it's not something anybody wants to see happen. But I can't imagine the type of pressure they would be under to, again, try to move things forward, not backward.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, it was interesting to watch Mayor Lightfoot time the opening for Chicago to, the Friday opening of the state. So they're trying, I think, in some places to move lockstep. And I think that's important. But you may well see parts of the state doing better or worse. So not only to reverberate the point that Brian made, but you might see pieces of the state fall backwards, but others be able to maintain or move forward. And one of the things that I've been sort of paying a lot of attention to recently is, you know, what are norms for mask wearing? You know, walk out, you know, walk around in Chicago and, you know, it's pretty variable. Until those norms shift and become uniform, there is a real risk of backsliding.
Some of the reasons why we are moving into phase four is the widespread testing availability, contact tracing that's now more available. But you've talked to people who question if the move to phase four, is it a good time to do that?
Yeah, you know, I went and pulled, you know, what it says about phase four. And, you know, then one of the key metrics is that testing is widely available and that tracing is commonplace. Of course, to go to five, you need all of that to be widely available, you know, testing, tracing, and treatment. And I do a sort of morning epidemiology call twice a week with a lot of public health folks at Northwestern, at UIC, other places. And I just kind of ask them, you know, we're moving into four, where are we with testing and tracing? And, you know, the sense was that the testing is widely available for people with symptoms, but not necessarily for the general public. You know, general public might have to go to the county testing facilities. Those, of course, people have been working double time to get, you know, testing available and open, but you know, that may be spotty, and even more on the contact tracing. You know, it's gearing up and there's federal funding now flowing in to get small armies of folks to be able to do this. And a lot of it rests on those folks being in place. And I think that's a lot more nascent at this point.
Brian, you have talked, you mentioned, with some public health officials. Are they happy with this move to phase four? Do they think it's the right time?
Well, they vary, and some of them, one of the questions we've asked them was how personally comfortable are they with various activities? And the ones who are elaborating that they're not very comfortable themselves with activities like dining in restaurants or attending a large in-person meeting had to do with the point Robin made, that they're seeing a lot of people not wearing masks. They're seeing people not really trying hard to maintain social distance. And I think the sense that we're really not sure there couldn't be another outbreak is pretty common. And contact tracing gets much harder as there's more of an outbreak as well. So contact tracing is easy as the statistics are getting better and easier. But if there are a lot more cases, it's a harder thing. And I'm a parent of four, so I'm keenly aware of the fact that not that long from now, school openings are gonna be a really severe test for whether or not there's first a lot more exposure, and then with the surge of cases, all of these dominoes could start falling, hospital capacity falls. So the loosening of restrictions is certainly good news for their day-to-day lives, but it also means there's more risk, and that you know, we really could end up with a series of bad outcomes that again mean we end up shifting back.
And Brian, you follow politics for a living, and you've studied this for years, but how much does that play into some of these decisions?
Certainly there's a palpable sense that a lot of people are impatient with this sense that life is on hold and that a lot of normal things can't be done. And I guess, again, I go to the interesting contrast with these experts we polled about when they'll be comfortable with riding a bus or a train or taking a flight. And a lot of these activities, many of them said they're waiting for a vaccine. And that's, I study politics for a living and not epidemiology, but I gather that even with successful research, a vaccine is still months and months away. The most rapid fire implementation would be many months.
You know, it's funny because we talk about these phases like they're miraculously throwing a switch and our society just sort of lurches back to some normal thing. But even, you know, even coming into this, we saw people voluntarily withdrawing from society. They pulled back into themselves to be safe before they were told they had to do that. Now, some folks waited, you know, until the nth moment, and for all kinds of good reasons, like they don't have lots of economic better choices, right? They need to work, but many people voluntarily sort of turned into themselves, and we're seeing that out of new economics research. And I think one of the things that will happen if we can't get these norms online, you know, and get people widespread, you know, observing safety for everyone's benefit, not just their own, is that it's going to scare the bejesus out of people. People will be like, you know what, don't need to go to a movie. I'm just not there. And we're seeing that with our experts, but you know down in your gut that there are things that you wouldn't feel good about doing. So I think it's going to be a while, whatever labels we put on it, whatever permissive rules that are there, people will respect the norms. If those norms shift, then I think they'll feel comfortable. If they don't shift, then I wonder how much these phases matter.
I guess the one thing I didn't mention was we asked these people, when are you going to be comfortable with these activities? Now, the end of summer, autumn, a year from now, only when there's a vaccine or never. The one case where people said, a lot of them, about a quarter of them said never, was shaking hands, that there might be some activities that will just vanish, that you can cordially meet and encounter a stranger without sharing germs. And so it wouldn't surprise me if we come out of this with some norms that are utterly different. People didn't say they'll never ride an airplane again. They said they're waiting for a vaccine, but a quarter of them said they can't ever imagine shaking hands.
U of I Professor Brian Gaines and Institute of Government and Public Affairs Director Robin Fretwell-Wilson talked about the latest findings in the Pandemic Stress Indicator. You can find more details on that at statewideshow.com. The University of Illinois says it has crafted a plan to have students return to campus. Despite precautions, officials there say that outbreaks could still occur. Christine Herman has more on how they're preparing.
Precautions include holding a mix of in-person and online classes, spacing people out as much as possible, requiring masks and social distancing, and offering regular COVID-19 testing. But students could still get sick, so U of I officials say they're setting aside 5% of on-campus housing to accommodate students needing to isolate or quarantine. These students would be provided meals, and instructors are expected to make arrangements for remote learning. In a webinar, officials said freshmen are still required to live on campus, despite some parents wanting to move them off campus for safety reasons. Officials said students will need to apply to live off campus, proving they have a medical condition or will be commuting from home within a 40-mile radius. I'm Christine Herman.
We have more of Statewide ahead. We'll hear what happened in a nursing home during an outbreak of COVID-19. That's coming up next. Support for Statewide comes from AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. There's a bear on the loose in western Illinois. It's traveled quite a way from Wisconsin. We'll talk to a biologist who is tracking its movement. And later, Illinois' often unknown history of slavery. That's ahead on Statewide. The number of active coronavirus cases is on the decline in McLean County. It spiked in mid-May after a major outbreak at the Bloomington Rehabilitation and Healthcare Center, a facility that government records show struggled to provide quality care and adequate staffing even before the virus hit. Ryan Denham has this look inside the nursing home, and a warning, some of the audio is disturbing.
Over and over again, the same employees at Bloomington Rehab Nursing Home picked up the phone and called 911.
What is your name?
Cindy, RN.
And your name?
It's Brandy.
What's your name?
It's Shelley.
Cindy, RN.
It's Brandy.
Shelley.
It was Tuesday, May 12th, and the outbreak at Bloomington Rehab was about to go from bad to worse. 2 days before Mother's Day, the McLean County Health Department announced the first 5 positive tests at the nursing home. Soon, testing would turn up 54 others. On this Tuesday, a 72-year-old resident in room 16 at Bloomington Rehab was not doing well, so she called 911 on herself.
911, what's the address of the emergency?
It's Bloomington Rehab Center. I want to go to the hospital, and they're not letting me go.
The caller was Marlene Cohen's Hill. She said she was a dialysis patient, and she begged to be taken to the hospital.
Can somebody help me?
Well, you said that you've got your dialysis scheduled for this afternoon. You'll have to go to your appointment then.
I can't breathe. I can't catch my breath.
The paramedics were dispatched, but Marlene stayed at Bloomington Rehab. 2 days later, another 911 call. This time, it's an agency nurse calling for Marlene in room 16.
Tell me exactly what happened.
We have a resident. We just got the results back. She tested positive for COVID, but her her O2 stats have gone down in the 80s. She's shivering, yelling that her head is hurting, running a temperature, and she's on dialysis. But she's declining quickly.
Paramedics were sent again. This time, Marlene made it to OSF St. Joseph Medical Center, but she died the next day. She is one of nine residents and one employee at Bloomington Rehab to die after contracting COVID-19. It's McLean County's worst outbreak to date. Audio recordings of 911 calls made from Bloomington Rehab show the crisis slowly unfolding over a week, one patient at a time. WGLT obtained the calls through a records request. They reveal a staff working under incredibly difficult circumstances as the virus spread. They ask again and again for deteriorating patients to be taken to the hospital.
We actually have a COVID positive patient right now, and we can't keep her stats up. She keeps dropping. Her temp's up to 102.
Okay.
I need to send her in.
They even warned the paramedics.
So make sure they're prepared to dress for possible. We're starting to get results in.
Okay.
But it's Marlene's case that stands out. Peoria-based Peterson Healthcare owns Bloomington Rehab, and Senior Vice President of Operations Greg Wilson says he was not familiar with her case specifically. When asked if it's common for residents to call 911 for themselves rather than a nurse, he says yes, that would be unusual. Her family has hired a lawyer who is reviewing the case. The outbreak at this particular nursing home has subsided. Wilson says they have no active cases right now. Because they'd already restricted visitors when the outbreak began, Wilson says their working theory is that an asymptomatic employee or other healthcare professional brought it into the building. And it's not just that building. The coronavirus has ravaged long-term care facilities across the country. Over half of Illinois' 6,600 deaths are tied to such facilities. The state recently began requiring all nursing homes to test every resident and employee. That's already turned up at least one positive asymptomatic case of the virus at a Bloomington healthcare facility. I'm Ryan Denham.
Nursing homes enjoy fairly broad legal immunity from COVID-related civil liability. That's thanks to an executive order signed by the governor in April. That degree of immunity, which has drawn criticism, does not cover cases of gross negligence or willful misconduct. Over the past 3 years, a community police review board in Springfield has only considered a single case, and as Mary Hansen reports, there are differing thoughts on why the board has such a light caseload and if change is needed.
City leaders wrangled with forming the Police Community Review Commission for more than a decade before establishing it in 2005. The review board has struggled off and on since. The mayor appointed Kelvin Coburn to the commission along with five more new members in 2017, after it had been dormant for several years, says Coburn.
What we have is processes in place to make sure that each case is heard, to make sure that the community is collaborating with the police.
The commission's job is to check the work of the police department's internal affairs division. When a citizen complains about police misconduct, the internal affairs division investigates. If it finds no wrongdoing and the chief gives no punishment, a citizen can appeal that decision to the Police Community Review Commission. Commissioners look over the investigation, hear from both sides, and then vote to agree with the chief, disagree, or refer it back to internal affairs for further investigation. But documents show the review panel has met infrequently because it hasn't been assigned cases. Numbers from the police department show residents filed 14 misconduct allegations between 2017 and 2019. In just more than half, the police chief disciplined officers, and those cases couldn't have been referred to the commission. Of the remaining cases, one complainant appealed to the review panel. He didn't show up for a hearing last April, and it's unclear if the commission made a recommendation. Springfield Police Chief Kenny Winslow has said the lack of complaints shows the department is doing a good job. Sunshine Clemens, president of Black Lives Matter Springfield, says she hears from many who don't know the Police Review Commission exists and in general don't trust the complaint process.
Me telling them that, you know, they're treating me unfairly or doing something wrong or whatever is not going to make a difference because this is a historical thing that we've seen where it doesn't seem to matter what the community or the public says.
A deputy chief told NPR Illinois the department has tried to welcome complaints. The Internal Affairs Office is based just south of downtown, off 5th Street, so residents don't have to go to the police station to file a complaint. The deputy chief says being able to review body cam footage has also helped clear up misunderstandings between officers and residents. Coburn, the police panel's most recent chair, says the biggest issue is that it's underutilized.
My message to all the people who are criticizing it, you're just playing politics. Sit down somewhere because you do not have enough data to even judge the effectiveness of the commission.
Liana Perez is training director for the National Association for Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement. Her organization offers advice and best practices for agencies watching over the police. Perez says figuring out whether there aren't any complaints because the department is doing well or because people don't trust or know about the process is difficult.
So the most you can do is do your due diligence on the other side and get the information out there.
She says commissioners and city officials have to be advocates for the complaint process.
The biggest things that you're trying to accomplish is that accountability and transparency to give the community trust in their law enforcement agency.
Recent police killings in other cities and protests against them here have brought more scrutiny to law enforcement. A handful of city council members are drafting up changes to the police commission as part of a larger reform package.
It hasn't been fixed yet. I mean, maybe it's made some steps forward. I would agree with that, but it definitely is a long way off from where it needs to be.
That's Ward 2 Alderman Sean Gregory, who represents part of the east side of Springfield.
Me being from this community, I know that there's more of a concern than what has been reported.
Gregory says they expect to bring their proposals to the city council for discussion in a few weeks. I'm Mary Hansen.
Colleges and universities have received billions in federal money to help support students during the COVID-19 pandemic, but they can't give it to the nearly 500,000 undocumented students enrolled across the country, even those protected under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. Lee Gaines with Illinois Newsroom reports some undocumented students in Illinois are struggling to find ways to pay for next year's tuition.
Lizbeth Hernandez says her situation is exhausting. She's about to be a senior at Dominican University in Chicago's western suburbs. Hernandez is undocumented, which means she doesn't qualify for federal financial aid.
Once school is done, I go straight to work. So that's just like really mentally exhausting. And then going back home and trying to do homework at midnight and then waking up really early trying to catch the bus. So it's like, I don't know, it's a vicious cycle.
And that's before the pandemic cost Hernandez her job as a server at a restaurant. Her family also doesn't qualify for the $1,200 stimulus checks that went out earlier this year. And Hernandez says she's been rejected from unemployment benefits. She says she needs to work.
I depend on my summers to make most of my income for the school year, and that I've already wasted half of my summer not making any money.
Hernandez says she has to come up with about $9,000 for the next school year, even with a scholarship from Dominican that pays for 3/4 of her tuition. The university also gave her an extra $750 this year because of the pandemic. Hernandez has lived in the U.S. since she was an infant, and she's frustrated that she's been denied federal financial aid.
They won't help me, I guess. That's what I kind of like wrap my head around. So it's always been just about me and like getting myself through it, you know?
Hernandez says cobbling together some financial aid from the state, scholarships from Dominican and other places, she should be able to graduate from college next year. Dominican claims about 10% of their student body is undocumented. Donna Carroll is the college's president. She says that's because they're known for providing generous financial aid packages to those students.
I used to get questions from colleague presidents about how are you doing this? Aren't your donors upset? Aren't your alumni questioning? And I would always say, actually, the reverse is true.
Over the years, Carroll says they've received funding from donors who specifically want to help undocumented students. Recently, the university received about $3 million in federal COVID-19 assistance. But Carroll says they can only spend it on those who qualify for federal student aid. So they're fundraising to help students who aren't eligible. Candy Marshall says schools are getting creative in how they support undocumented students.
Their view is, look, if we have all this money coming in, emergency fund money, that we're only going to be able to spend on U.S. citizens, then what we can do is go look at other buckets of money that might have been used to support U.S. citizens, and we'll use those buckets of money to support our undocumented students.
Marshall heads an organization called the Dream.us, which partners with colleges across the country to fund tuition for undocumented students. She fears undocumented students might drop out if they can't afford to pay their tuition, even if it's just a few thousand dollars a year.
We started to get inquiries from students across the country saying, I think I should drop all of my classes this term, or I think I need to go down to one class, or I'm questioning whether I can even afford to stay in college.
But Marshall says college and university leaders need to do more than just provide undocumented students with tuition money. She says they also need to advocate for policies that would give them access to federal financial aid, and not just during a pandemic, but as a matter of course. I'm Lee Gaines.
Authorities are advising residents to avoid getting close to a black bear that has been seen repeatedly over the last couple of weeks, most recently in western Illinois. Stephanie Fitzsimmons is a wildlife biologist with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. She's following the bear's journey. She took a few moments to talk with us about it.
We work closely with USDA Wildlife Services in the state of Illinois for large carnivore situations. And so they actually let me know that this particular bear was at the Wisconsin-Illinois state line on June 5th. It was hanging around Monroe, Wisconsin. And then on June 10th, it passed into Illinois in Joe Davies County. Just a little bit after that, it actually swam the Mississippi River. We think it swam the river. We're not sure if it crossed over a bridge. We think it swam the river into Iowa, spent some time in Iowa. And then on June 18th, it did swim the Mississippi River and over into Andalusia, Illinois. And it's been hanging around in Illinois since.
Why would it be making this type of journey?
We've had instances in the past where black bear males have ventured into Illinois at this time of year. We're not 100% sure it's a male. Males usually have a very large home range, and so they go wandering to find a mate. We don't have a resident bear population. We don't have a mate for it. So this bear is just on a very long journey, an extra long journey to find a mate, which he won't find in Illinois.
Well, how common is it that a bear would come from the north, like Wisconsin, and wind up in Illinois? Does this happen a lot?
So it doesn't happen a lot, but this is definitely not going to be the last time this has happened. So if you go on our Wildlife Illinois website, there's a page dedicated to black bears, and it has all the dates of the positively confirmed black bear sightings in Illinois. And they're usually right around this time, more than you think, but it's still a very rare situation.
Well, Department of Natural Resources, I know, put out a news release this week encouraging the public to leave the bear alone. Of course, people want to see it, I'm sure, if they heard it's nearby. What are some of the concerns here, and when does the agency possibly take some action? Is there a policy toward that?
We have a large carnivore protocol that includes instances of black bear. The thing is what we want to press home to the public is we don't want to intervene with this black bear. We want it to safely continue its journey to its final destination, wherever that is. We need the public to leave the bear alone. You know, black bears are the smallest black bear or smallest bear species. They're pretty timid. But when provoked, they can attack. Now, this particular black bear has had no human property conflicts that it has instigated. The only problems that it has had have been human instigated. So overcrowding, trying to get pictures of it, being way too close or blocking it up against a fence or anything like that, that kind of happened over Father's Day weekend here in Illinois. And we don't want that to happen. Because, you know, if the bear lashes out or starts destroying property, that's when USDA Wildlife Services and DNR we're going to have to step in. And we don't want to do that.
And then I'm sure there's somebody, a hunter or somebody out there who thinks, hey, an opportunity to bag a bear. Is that legal to do at this point?
No. So black bears are protected species in the state of Illinois. So they are not allowed to be harassed or hunted. If someone decided they wanted to hunt this bear in Illinois, they'd be in big trouble. This bear's outcome is 100% dependent on how people react around it. And we really just need people to stay away.
That's Stephanie Fitzsimmons, a wildlife biologist with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. And we've been talking about a black bear that's been making its way through parts of western Illinois. Up next, Illinois' history of slavery. Stay with us on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This is Statewide. Like us on Facebook and also check out our website at statewideshow.com. There's been a lot of discussion about racial justice and more focus recently on the history of slavery. And because Illinois is a northern state and former home to Abraham Lincoln, it's usually not associated with slavery, but it did take place here for more than 100 years, even as Lincoln was serving in the White House. A few years ago, we spotlighted an essay about the state's unexpected and in some cases unknown history of slavery. This week, we revisit that conversation that Jamie Dunn had with the author, Tara McClellan McAndrew.
Slavery came to Illinois pretty darn early. It was while the French owned our land, and it was part of the Louisiana Territory. A French businessman named Philippe Francis Renault brought 500 slaves from the Dominican Republic to develop a mine here near where Prairie du Rocher is now in southwestern Illinois. The mine did not succeed, so after a couple decades or so, Renault sold the slaves to residents and he left.
And Illinois' slave population grew from the time it was a territory to the time after it became a state. How much did it grow and what were some of the reasons for that?
Illinois' slave population really boomed from the time that it was a territory until about the mid-1800s. In 1810, according to the federal census, and this is when we were still a territory, we became a state in 1818. In 1810, Illinois had 168 slaves. In 1845, that number was nearly 5,000. A lot of the people who first settled Illinois settled in the South and tended to be from the southern states, which were slave-owning states. Many of them, as a result, had sympathies with that attitude and often had slaves themselves. They wanted to bring their slaves here with them. As Illinois was developing, the people here, of course, wanted to continue to develop and draw new settlers. And they realized that in order to do that, they had to draw from some of the states that were southern and also owned slaves. And if people didn't know if they could bring their slaves here or not, they might not want to come here. There's a very interesting writing by a man named N. Dwight Harris, and he wrote a book in the very early 1900s about slavery in Illinois. And he talked about some of the other reasons that our state was pro-slavery in its territory days and its early days as a state. So according to Harris's book, some of the other reasons that Illinois was essentially pro-slavery included settlers who were here believed that they needed slave help to settle the land. This is a really interesting next reason. They thought that having slaves here in Illinois would help disperse the slave population around the nation and thereby decrease the chance of having a slave revolt. But the last reason is my favorite, and it really involves some very creative thinking. Here's what he wrote. Quote, "Slavery here would provide the colored people with a partial escape from the servitude of the South by the possibility of a transfer to the lighter indentured servitude system of Illinois, and thereby be an inestimable blessing to blacks." Oh, the really creative thinking is just mind-boggling, but creative thinking is evident throughout our first state constitution and some of the constitutions that followed afterward. And what I mean by that is they practiced George Orwellian doublethink. I don't know if you remember the George Orwell book 1984, but they talked about the concept of doublethink, which is the process of holding two contradictory thoughts simultaneously and believing in them. Our state constitution did that, our first one, by both outlawing and allowing slavery in order to gain statehood. Congress mandated that Illinois become a free state. But we already had French slaves that were owned by some of the residents. We had Southern settlers who wanted to keep their slaves. The framers of our first constitution had to walk a fine line. They basically stated that slavery would not be introduced into this state, but existing slaves could still remain slaves, and those who were indentured servants would have to fill out the remainders of their contracts, and that would somehow be legal under this very contradictory document.
And what were some of the stances that Illinois politicians took on slavery?
Our territorial governor, Ninian Edwards, was pro-slavery. He was from the South. He owned slaves. And so he helped interpret some of our early laws and believed that, yes, our constitution, our territorial constitution, will still let us basically have slaves. Our first governor was also pro-slavery. Our second governor was not. Our third and our fourth were pro-slavery as well. So while Illinois had leaders who were pro-slavery, of course, our laws reflected that. Our second governor, Governor Edward Coles, was an anomaly in terms of our first state leaders who were largely pro-slavery. Coles was not, even though he came from a slaveholding state and inherited slaves from his father. In fact, he brought them to Illinois, where he freed them against the law. And during his inaugural address, he called for the abolition of slavery in Illinois. He called for laws that would prevent the kidnapping of free blacks and runaway slaves in Illinois. And he also called for a constitution which would put these things into law. For his anti-slavery attitudes and efforts, Coles basically lost all political power after his term as governor ended, and he ended up leaving the state.
And then your story also touches on an abolitionist who lost his life over the cause, Elijah Lovejoy. Can you tell me just a little bit about him?
Even though Illinois was largely pro-slavery in its early decades as a state, even from the beginning, we did have people who were anti-slavery and some who were out-and-out abolitionists. And one of the more well-known ones, was a printer named Elijah Lovejoy, who lived in Alton in 1837 and printed an anti-slavery newspaper. And unfortunately, because of his stance, he lost his life. A pro-slavery mob attacked him in Alton, destroyed his printer, and killed him.
Former slaves who had escaped to the North and free blacks in Illinois still had to worry about kidnapping. Why was that?
Not only was Illinois mostly pro-slavery in its earliest decades, but some of our citizens took it a step further, and we basically had what some people call a reverse underground railroad. One of our laws basically kind of encouraged that attitude. An 1819 state law mandated that citizens interrogate blacks to determine if they were free or if they were runaway slaves. And if they were the latter, the white interrogator got money for it. I think it was $10. Some took that further, especially some folks who were fervently pro-slavery and anti-black who lived in southern Illinois. Some of those folks would actually kidnap runaway slaves and even free blacks who possibly didn't have their freedom papers with them, and they would return them to the South where they would make money from their sale. According to a relatively new book by a man named Daryl Dexter and called Bondage in Egypt, which is about slavery in Southern Illinois, some of these kidnappers were so bold that they would actually go up to the homes of free blacks and kidnap their children. His book says that black children were especially at the greatest risk of being kidnapped by slave catchers and taken back down to the South and sold back into slavery or into slavery for the first time.
Your story talks about something called the Black Codes. Can you tell me what the Black Codes were?
The Black Codes were laws that Illinois passed over its earliest decades as a state, which basically served as a way to tell all African Americans, free or runaway slaves, don't come here. Don't come here. Don't settle here. It was our unwelcome sign. As we grew older as a new state, those Black Codes only worsened and became harsher. For instance, some of the Black Codes prevented blacks from being in Illinois for more than 10 days. or they could be arrested, fined, and auctioned off. Free Blacks and their children had to prove they were free by showing certificates of freedom with their county seat shortly after their arrival. Slaves or servants had to have written permission to go farther than 10 miles from their master's homestead or risk being whipped. Blacks could not gather in groups of three or more to make revelry or dance, or they could be whipped. And to add to this, Blacks could not serve in the militia, could not vote, and could not testify in court. And the latter two, of course, prevented them from having any power to change their status as powerless.
How does Illinois' history of slavery compare with other northern states, with some of our neighbors?
Illinois wasn't the only northern state that had slavery, although we appear in some ways to have perhaps among the worst records of it. Indiana became a state 2 years earlier than Illinois did, and its first constitution outlawed slavery, like ours did. However, like our first constitution, Indiana's also condoned indentured servitude for a few decades. And when Illinois became a state 2 years later, we basically borrowed that part of Indiana's constitution, which outlawed slavery and yet allowed indentured servitude. According to an historian, Christopher Lehman, who studied Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, or the Upper Mississippi Valley states, he studied slavery in this region, our constitution, compared to those other states, was the only one that allowed slavery and indentured servitude. Wisconsin followed the lead of Illinois and did let slaves work in its mines, but eventually that stopped around the 1830s. What it sounds like some other northern states did was say, we're not going to allow slavery, but we're also not going to allow any blacks in our communities. And we didn't quite go that far, but we got awfully close because of our black laws.
I'm sure you talk with folks about Illinois history fairly frequently. How often do you find that people are surprised by Illinois' slave history?
I find that people are surprised when they learn that Illinois had slaves all the time. In fact, some of the historians I interviewed about slavery in Illinois, at least two of them told me that they didn't know Illinois had slaves until they were working on their undergraduate or graduate degrees in history. I think that says a lot. Your average person probably has no idea that Illinois really was a quasi-slave state. How many of us think of the home or the hometown? Springfield even had a slave auction. Abraham Lincoln's relatives, some of his relatives by marriage, who lived here, owned slaves. It's hard to believe. We're always lauded, especially in Illinois, as a free state, the home of the emancipator. But we weren't, and we weren't for a long time, from approximately 1719 until about 1863 or 1865. We had slaves. You can look at our newspapers around the state. We had ads selling slaves. We had ads for slave catcher services. It's there.
Why do you think it's important for people today to understand this part of our state's history?
Number one, just because it's the truth. We have to face the truth, no matter how ugly or unwanted. And I am not an expert on this, but I personally believe that that history, as all history does, has to affect us today. It happened. It has to have affected how we act as a community, as an estate today. There's one more thing I want to say about this. Some people think that because slavery existed in the North, it might have been a lighter version, you know, slavery light, if you will. But some of the historians that I talked to or whose books I read said that it could be the treatments of slaves could be just as harsh as it was in the South. Just like in the South, some of them were sexually abused. Just like in the South, some of them were punished severely and whipped. One slave who tried to kill his master was sentenced to be whipped over 3 days. It wasn't necessarily slavery light. It was just slavery in the North.
That's Tara McClellan McAndrew talking with Jamie Dunn, the interview from 2016. If you'd like to read more about Illinois' history of slavery, you can find the essay at statewideshow.com. And next week on Statewide, we'll hear about some recently discovered firsthand accounts from slaves in Illinois, and we'll have more reports and conversations from in and around the state. In the meantime, follow us at statewideshow.com and through the NPR One app. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family as the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.